Thank you, everyone, for coming along to this afternoon session, balancing the challenges of mental health claims and insurance. A really important topic. You heard a few speakers touch on this morning. I got interested in this topic over the last 12 months or so. It really stemmed from reading about a decision in the Victorian is a Consumer Affairs Tribunal, VCAT. It was a decision against QBE where they were selling a travel insurance product which simply excluded at underwriting stage any customers who've had any mental health issues. And then there was a young lady who subsequently had a claim that was denied, she shouldn't have the policy. And in their defence, they relied on the exemptions to the Anti-Discrimination Act, which we do. However, what I didn't realise was that in order to rely on those exemptions, you need to have done your research prior to issuing the product, prior to making the decision. And while the defendant did a lot of research and demonstrated why it was reasonable for them to exclude applicants with mental health, that was done post the event and therefore was of no use to their defence. So they ultimately lost, and that has now meant that exclusion is inadmissible, or for them at least, not useful. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is quite fundamental to our business, since we're often dealing with mental health challenges. This is a claims topic, not an underwriting topic. Nevertheless, I think this is a critical issue for our industry and how we think differently about either broadening the cover that we can offer through clever product design or through pricing or through better claims management. So I'm delighted today that we have this paper to hear about some of the challenges and how we can manage that in the mental health sphere. The speakers that follow are going to tell you how they want you to think differently about this topic and about managing mental health claims. So I look forward to hearing about that. I will briefly introduce them. I've been asked several times not to go through their biographies. I'm not quite sure what Michael Dermody has to hide. maybe you know better than I do, but many of us know Michael. He's been in the industry for a long time, joined KPMG back in the last millennium, and even prior to that worked at AMP. He's nearly as old as I am. A very active member of the profession in a variety of committees and working groups with the Institute, and we're indebted to him, as well as our other speakers, Jane Daughter, who is very well known in this field. She's one of the people whose name always seems to come up when I hear the words biopsychosocial. I'm still trying to understand exactly what those words mean, and maybe you can help me with that. But Jane is very experienced across claims and underwriting of insurance claims, also currently in the KPMG practice. Joshua Martin, the third on our panel, is a senior consultant as well from KPMG's team. He's been there for 3 years, has a particular focus on CTP and workers' compensation areas. So it's great to see a range of different disciplines being represented in this paper today. So without further ado, I will turn over to my colleagues to present the paper. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. This presentation is a summary of the paper we gave, which looks at what insurers and in particular actuaries need to be doing to meet the challenges of mental health conditions. And there are three main parts to this presentation. In the first considers the complexity of mental health conditions and their treatment. And in particular, it focuses on the three sorts of factors that impact an individual's mental health. And they are biological, social, and psychological. Now, this background provides information for the second section, which will be presented by Jane, which considers results of studies that have already been done. These are studies that have already been done that establish clear relationships between certain specific social and psychological factors and a person's mental health. This presentation also looks at the factors and considers some of the examples that are already in place and hopefully will be in future as well about how technology and improvements in data capture can actually help us to leverage these known relationships and therefore better understand claims risks and improve the claims handling model. The final part of the presentation looks at us. It looks at the role of actuaries. And while product managers and claims managers are the ones that have prime responsibility for developing strategies to improve outcomes in their areas, our role as actuaries is to work alongside them as they develop their thinking and as they start to implement more data-driven and information-based strategies. So with that, I'll hand over to Josh.
Thank you, Michael. Before we can discuss the challenges of claims relating to mental illness, it is beneficial to have an understanding of the diseases we are talking about. So firstly, frequency of mental health conditions is high, with 1 in 5 Australians over the next 12 months to experience a mental illness, and 1 in 2 over a lifetime. The World Health Organization emphasizes that mental health is an integral and essential component of health, and the Australian government defines mental illness as a health problem that significantly affects how a person feels, thinks, behaves, and interacts with others. Mental illnesses are broadly categorized into how they disturb thoughts and behaviors in people. They are frequently split by diagnostic features that can be collated into subgroups of specific diagnoses, such as in the table here. It is worth noting that mood and anxiety disorders are the most common, particularly for insurers, and therefore are the focus of our presentation. Mood disorders refer to conditions that disturb a person's mood to a point where it becomes difficult to function in work or relationships. Anxiety disorders exist when an individual is unable to stop worrying and they perceive situations as worse than they actually are. So with this, we turn our attention to diagnosis. Now, unlike many physical illnesses, there isn't identifiable biomarkers, clinical or laboratory tests with which we can use to diagnose any condition that matches to the DSM-5, which is the 5th edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So therefore, by necessity, diagnoses are made based on clinical presentation and the patient's self-report on symptoms and disability. There is a school of thought that the evidence base for psychiatric medicine may lag significantly behind that of other medical disciplines. And there is some clinical and academic criticism that the DSM-5 lacks empirical evidence and inter-rater reliability for the listed diagnoses. However, notwithstanding these opinions, at present the DSM-5 remains the universal authority for diagnosis of psychiatric illnesses and is widely used for classification and diagnostic reference for insurance. To diagnose a mental disorder, the patient informs the clinician about their history, problems, and symptoms. This diagnosis is then used, integrated with the clinician's best interpretation of the patient's problems, with their observations of responses and behaviours during the interaction. Highly skilled clinicians with specific psychological expertise are very capable of critically thinking and making these clinical decisions to form diagnosis. As part of our process for this paper and for this presentation, we met with a variety of industry specialists, including psychiatrists. Now, the importance of highly skilled clinicians in the claims process was a reoccurring theme in these discussions. So without reliable and measurable biological markers to accurately diagnose mental health conditions, variation can emerge between clinicians regarding an individual's state of mental health. Rieger et al. 2013 questioned the reliability of the diagnosis of a number of common mental health conditions based on test-retest reliability trials of DSM-5 diagnostic criteria. This study showed that 2 independent clinicians would agree on the diagnosis of a specific mental health condition less than 39% of the time. The best diagnostic reliability was for post-traumatic stress disorder, which was showed agreement in diagnosis between clinicians 69% of the time, whilst the worst was for anxiety, mixed anxiety and depressive disorder, with agreement less than 10% of the time. So these results highlight that there are large inconsistencies in diagnosing a specific condition. While this is somewhat understandable, given the judgment involved, it is important for insurers to understand the implications of this when designing the claims management process, particularly when and how different health professionals are engaged. Insurers should also consider this for the benefit of developing insurance products, identifying potential issues and challenges for consumer, and from a customer service standpoint. So now let's understand the biopsychosocial model.
Thanks, Josh, and I think that gives you a nice background and lead into why we want to talk about the biopsychosocial model. So the biopsychosocial model recognises that there are challenges, just as Josh pointed out, in improving a person's health, but recognising, in fact, what is happening to that person's health. It recognises that it's far more complex than just the medical condition alone. What it looks at is that the strongest predictors, particularly of prolonged absence from the workplace, are in fact social and psychological factors rather than just the biomedical ones. Psychological factors, what they include are things like personality traits, beliefs, perceptions, and the individual's tendency towards particular behaviours. Now, what the social factors relate to are how they operate, how that individual operates in their environment, including the features of their specific cultural, socioeconomic, workplace, and the family circumstances. Mental health conditions are especially challenging due to this intricate and entwined characteristics of the individual and how these psychosocial factors may present them at clinical presentation, particularly when they're reporting these particular symptoms and behaviours to the psychiatrist. So this becomes then a key factor, particularly and a challenge for insurers in how to improve support and management at claims time, and that the appropriate intervention is considered, particularly for those early high-risk and high-complex claims, which we commonly now know have psychosocial factors. It's important because we already know that with adverse factors such as a diagnosis of a mental health condition, people deteriorate rapidly, and people also adapt quickly to being on claim, and therefore the barriers to return to work also increase. So with the understanding now of psychosocial factors, and we understand that these come from common stressful situations, are we in fact in the insurance sector driving people to a medical diagnosis? The boundary between normal distress and a pathological mental health condition can be difficult to ascertain. People without mental health conditions can become distressed, and their social circumstances become difficult. All of us in this room would have had an experience as such. Where mental health diagnostic criteria are measured on a continuum, the particular severity, the length, the frequency to satisfy a particular diagnostic criteria such as DSM-5, we also can see that it can be very arbitrary in its results, simply because of the unnoted psychosocial factors. Take major depressive disorder, for example. We know that it is 2 weeks of low mood that contributes to that diagnosis. So, a feeling of distress in certain situations, a relationship breakdown, missing a promotion, stems from the protective psychological process responding and properly to the psychological stressful situation. This can be often a normal response. But to have a pathological mental disorder, these protective psychological mechanisms would not be functioning appropriately. Development of emotional or behavioural symptoms in response to the onset of a stressor occurs within 3 months. However, it should also be expected to cease within 6. So if the wider context of the person's reaction to their individual circumstances is not adequately understood, therefore we include the psychosocial factors, a normal reaction to an abnormal situation may unfortunately be medicalised as an illness. Analysis by Safe Work Australia in 2015 showed that 41% of workers' compensation mental health claims were due to reaction to stresses rather than a specific DSM-5 diagnosis. So the insurance sector, particularly us in life as well, need to ask ourselves, does the need for a diagnosis push people into the pathologising or medicalisation of appropriate reactions to distressing psychosocial situations? Separating impairment, disability and handicap has often been the traditional focus of insurers, and the International Classification of Impairments, Disabilities and Handicaps is published by WHO to provide a conceptual framework for disability. And we know this forms the basis of insurance products and often definitions. However, a biopsychosocial model is now standard approach in clinical settings. the biopsychosocial model acknowledges the influences of a range of non-medical factors on people's well-being. It acknowledges that people vary. They vary in their individual resilience, their ability to make sense of potentially traumatic events, the level of support they perceive they need, and their ability to maintain an awareness of self and security. These factors impact their level of ongoing distress. And it's this management of the incapacity, the pain, the frustration that all cause the feelings of distress, but are often not considered when diagnoses are made or when treatment pathways are formed. We also know that the less resilient an individual, and given that their personality traits may have a particular factor, the more exaggerated and exacerbated their response to their circumstances can be. So in the early 2000s, there was a lot of recognition, particularly in the compensation sector such as life and workers' comp, that claims management needed to have a more holistic approach. And over time, since then, claims organisations have developed a better appreciation of the social and the psychological aspects of claims and the benefits of early intervention. Nonetheless, the implementation of this claims management model is not without its challenges, including quickly and accurately identifying the biopsychosocial factors associated with a particular claim. And while there's some automation going on at present, a significant amount of the processing and the analysis of this information to assess the social and the psychological risk factors is performed by the claims professional. We know that this can lead to delays before high-risk factors are identified in a claim, and notwithstanding and assessing the risk as accurately and consistently as possible can also lead to going down the wrong pathway. Achieving good outcomes being significantly dependent, therefore, also on the claims person's capability and their understanding of the psychosocial factors. More time and effort is also required for processing the analysis, and it could possibly potentially be automated with different new forms of technology such as cognitive and artificial intelligence. Identification is the key here to making this more accurate and timely. An identification of the psychosocial factors impacting the claim have been studied in the workers' compensation sector in the US. As you can see here, at initial evaluation, people self-reported on 11 risk psychosocial factors for chronicity of symptoms and disability. The results of these questions enable clustering of people into four subgroups, and you can see those four subgroups at the bottom of the graph there. 8 of the 11 psychosocial measures collected in initial evaluation showed significant predictors associated with recovery and return to work at 3 months. And this was performed in 2012. These 8 factors are outlined, as you can see in the chart there. And it's noted that insight into these 8 significant indicators can be obtained by the claims professional enabling themselves, perhaps through technology or through capability, of building rapport with the person on claim, asking relevant questions, and exploring people's individual circumstances. We know that when this data is collected at claims notification, it can be utilised to flag both risk and the indications, the right indications, for early intervention. So what else have studies shown us? As Michael pointed out, there has been significant research and studies in this area over probably about 40 years now. And this extensive clinical research and studies links the relationships between specific biopsychosocial factors and mental health incidents and recovery, even in the insurance sector. This slide is not exhaustive, but it does include factors, a range of psychological and social factors that are likely to be of interest to us here as actuaries and claims professionals. We hope it's going to prompt you perhaps to reflect on what you look at in your organisation. What ones are listed here, are they included or perhaps they're not included at the current state in your factors that you understand when looking at incidents and recovery for mental health people on claim. Return to work expectations is one area, and a person's own perception and expectation of their return to work has been shown to be a very good predictor of claim complexity and duration. Cooperation and trust. The development of a positive therapeutic alliance is a reliable predictor of positive clinical outcomes in both mental and physical conditions. This has actually been shown time and time again in various claims at an international level. Cooperation and accountability develops with trust. This in turn leads to more open and honest conversations and improve participation in recovery activities. Not surprisingly, this results in more rapid recovery time. The workplace. Underlying factors which have been shown to be important and which we need to include in understanding people on claim include, has there been any workplace conflict? Is there a poor work-life balance and high job demands? Are there low levels of autonomy at work? The significant research about the workplace environment and how it correlates with people's motivation to return. Job insecurity is another one and increases the odds of self-reported poor health. The other interesting one, which gives us a new angle to start to consider, is personality. It's a common and widely used framework, and personality allows us to look at the different traits of a particular individual and correlate them with the likely complexity of a return to work pathway. A commonly used framework is the FFM, and we don't really have enough time to go into the model here today, but it does break down personality into five high-level factors. It looks at emotional stability, openness to experience, conscientiousness, agreeableness, and extroversion. Importantly for us, impersonality has been shown to be a relatively stable indicator over a person's lifetime. And there's been a large number of studies on the link between personality traits and mental health incidents and mental health recovery. Of the five big factors, low emotional stability was the strongest correlate across the board. But other factors, including low conscientiousness and low extroversion, were also found to be associated with poorer outcomes and conditions. The analysis on personality, including both incidents and recovery time, can alter also the effectiveness of how we approach treatment with people. So where can the technology advances that we all keep getting excited about at the moment, when we talk about artificial intelligence and cognitive intelligence, enable the claims experience and the claims process? Well, we think that the implementation of the biopsychosocial model can be significantly enabled by some of the work that's going on in cognitive intelligence, particularly now since biopsychosocial has been recognised as, when done in a timely and accurately manner, will have a significant impact on the outcome of a claim. But speed and accuracy are in the important elements here. Potential delays and accuracy issues can stem from the fact that while there is some automation going on with various claim systems and technology and rule sets, there is a significant amount of processing and analysis of information to assess social and psychological risk factors which is performed by the claims professional. How do we speed this up and get it more accurate? Well, we've considered potentially two examples, and these rely on some of the new technology, particularly in the cognitive intelligence space. These are only intended to be illustrative for you and to understand at the conceptual level, but they're already occurring in many markets, particularly at international levels. And who knows where they're going to go next? Historically, values on the big five personality factors and the underlying traits have been obtained through specific personality tests, which ask about 60 to 240 questions. We're certainly not going to go there again with many of our customers asking questions like that after they've already had to apply at about 240 questions. So advances in technology with cognitive analysis enable such analysis to be formed using spoken or even the written input. Just 600 words from a person coming on claim will announce certain cognitive intelligence to give us a personality, if you like, sunburst such as this. Good claims professionals analyse conversations currently and written information to understand the biopsychosocial risk factors. Cognitive intelligence can enable us to do this within a matter of minutes. Cognitive intelligence has the ability to automatically provide the claims professional with additional information that has the potential to be timely and accurate and even in real time. Personality trait information will assist with mental health claims particularly, because another factor that can be also understood through personality traits is how to gain more trust and engagement with the individual. It may be possible through the use of cognitive intelligence to improve engagement by pairing the individual, based on such things as his personality profile, with a particular claims professional or health professional. They are more likely, through an understanding of the particular personality traits, to get a trusting, respectful and positive relationship which could go towards cooperation in the claims management pathway. Examples already exist of this. Technology is being used to pair, at the moment in the mental health sector, therapists with patients. And this includes commercially available applications such as Mentrix. They are emerging to integrate holistic data, including many psychosocial factors regarding an individual's health risk. One of the other interesting things that Cognitive is now enabling to do in real time through the actual recordings of particular telephone conversations, which is a common tool used in claims organisations at the moment, is the use of tone and sentiment analysis. And with Cognitive, it can be similarly used to provide real-time insights into how a customer is actually progressing and interacting with you. Some staff are excellent in the claims organisations at interpreting particular speech patterns, adjusting their approach accordingly. But real-time analysis using cognitive intelligence will allow us to pick up tone and sentiment on the call using cognitive to allow the claims person to then respond in real time, to adjust the way that they're asking particular questions, to build closer rapport, and in turn, build better trust. This allows the case managers in the claims organisation to adjust their approach and see in real time whether they're effectively also addressing the particular concerns of the people on claim. Cognitive computing can facilitate written communication as well, as people respond differently between verbal communication and written communication. It has the capacity to read the Bible within about 5 minutes, if not less. It can read claim forms and interpret different aspects of people's sentiment, emotions, and therefore personality traits from less than 600 words. So these specific communications can be designed and drafted in a style to reflect words and methods that then allow us to understand psychosocial risk factors and issues that might be underlying and driving the claim's duration. This then in turn also can allow the organisation and the claims professionals to respond and articulate in an empathic and respectful manner to the person on claim.
Great, thanks Jane. Well, now for the hard part, or maybe the fun part, maybe both. Now, given all that Jane's talked about relationships between psychological and social factors, mental health conditions, now given all that we know about the technology aspects that Jane's talked about that's now enabling analysis to be done and data extraction information, now the question is what, of course, should actuaries be doing? And obviously we've got the paper there, we've got our thoughts there. I've also got and I'll go through these in a moment, the ones on the slide. I'm interested in the discussion. I'm particularly interested in ideas and thoughts that that you've got as well. So quickly roll through them. We've got expand the business understanding in the claims context. We need to do more of that. We need to understand that better. We need to make the actuarial basis more predictive. A lot of our analysis is on a portfolio basis, so it's too high level. We need to share insights and improve the feedback loop with operations and work more closely with them. We need to identify risks, opportunities and uncertainties. So I'll just expand on a couple of those. In terms of expanding our business understanding and claims context, I mean, I hope this presentation has given you an appreciation of, you know, just, you know, how much there is to explore. You know, how many factors beyond a simple, high-level claim cause, or beyond a case estimate provided by a claims manager, like how much other data and information there is to explore. In fact, one of the things when we started out on this paper is that we acknowledge that there are so many that it can be daunting. And so when we met with industry professionals preparing the paper, we made sure that we asked them if they could pick one particular factor, what would it be? And some of those are in the paper. So you've got the expectations of the person on claims when they think they're going to return to work. One claims manager said who the individual claims manager is. You've got perceptions of pain, trust, all sorts of things. Now, the point of trying to get a focus down to one factor was not because we believe that there is single one best claims factor across any particular portfolio or all portfolios or all populations. It was about demonstrating and recognising that what we need to do as actuaries and businesses is harness the insights and the expertise from all of the people that we work with We need to work with them, and when we do that, it helps us narrow what we need to look at it, and it helps us to focus. Our role as actuaries also involves us peering into the future, considering how the environment might change, and advising on risks and opportunities. So one thing we talk a bit about in the paper is that, you know, our role, and something we really need to work on, is thinking about, well, given we've got all these social and psychological factors, what changes can occur in the environment that might drive changes in those and then impact our claims experience? Workplaces, how likely are they to become more stressful? How effective are some of the workplace wellness programs in industries and particular companies likely to be in reducing stress? A big one is social acceptability of mental health conditions. Reducing the stigma associated with mental health conditions is a commonly recognised source of the increased incidence, as well as the lengthening duration of claims that we've seen. And some people we spoke with saw that, you know, that particular trend might have some way still to run. There are other factors as well, unemployment, economic factors, changes to family structures, public health, community health, funding, effectiveness, etc. Now, we don't know how all of those are going to develop, but an important part of this is being aware of their potential, because it will improve our ability to detect problems before they become a fully developed trend in the financial results. I do want to leave a fair bit of time for questions, so I won't talk a lot about data. We acknowledge the data challenges. Accessing data and linking it, I think this diagram is quite useful. It highlights the diversity of all of the data sources. There's a huge range of data sources, many of which, you know, I mean, some people might not be aware, and things like agent opt-in, opt-out might increase the amount of data that we're collecting. But importantly, what actuaries need to do is we need to be involved in the data capture and analysis discussions. We need to be involved in things like, how do we change questions to get more relevant information? We need to think about what tools are available, what changes do we need to make to systems to actually enable this data to be accessed and linked together. And importantly, technology is helping in all of this. It's making this analysis possible that was previously unaffordable and unthought of. So to conclude, claims managers are telling us, actuaries, that they are hungry for analysis and insights. Claims managers know that they don't have all the answers. Businesses need actuaries with an understanding of technology and the business context to grasp opportunities to improve customer experiences and claims outcomes. So thank you for your attention, and I look forward to the discussion.
Great. Thank you, Michael, Jane, and Joshua. Can I just kick off? Let me see if I understood correctly. Okay, so DSM-5, the manual for diagnosing mental health conditions. You said it was widely used. The universal authority, I think, were your words. At the FSC conference recently, I made a similar remark on a panel, and I got shot down by Dr. Samuel, who then pretty much said it was not nearly as widely used as it should be. Whether it is or not, I think I'm understanding that the biopsychosocial model, though, is going to consider a lot of other factors that aren't maybe considered under DSM-5. Would that be right, Jane? Or Joshua?
So I think the message there, Andrew, was that DSM-5 is the universal criteria for measuring whether someone meets the criteria for a mental health diagnosis, therefore a mental health condition or not. what the point really that I think some of us are trying to say here today in the insurance sector is that we see a very high incidence of mental health diagnoses and mental health conditions, and possibly because our structure and our processes push people into the medical model. We insist by way of our policies that people have a diagnosis and under regular care and attention of doctors, and therefore require a diagnosis, because that's in fact what the medical model perpetuates. What we understand from some of the workers' compensation sector and also from some of the disability sector in the United States is that many people, in fact, if you look at them retrospectively, don't in fact really have mental health diagnoses, but tend to lean more towards psychosocial conditions. That is, conditions that tend to have multiple factors to do with their psychological circumstances and their social circumstances that would be considered as normal responses to very difficult situations. However, many of these people don't receive, whether it be by way of public policy and what is available through the public community health system, the right treatment pathways. But they come across our desk because of their insurance policies. And we are having a tendency then to push them into the medical model, where many of them could actually be treated well through the psychosocial model. Now, because there is not significant amount of research that's been done, particularly locally in Australia, about psychosocial treatment pathways, it is a challenge now to the insurance sector to consider, should we be looking at many of our mental health claims and looking to see if they are actually, in fact, common psychological or social circumstances, and is there a better way to support these people rather than pushing them through to the medical model?
And might that have an impact then on product? So we...
It could have an impact on product. It could have an impact on price. It could have an impact on significant ways that we do our business.
Excellent.
But it could be one of the also bases. It's an interesting hypothesis as to why some of our mental health incidence is so high.
Right. I've got a long list of questions I would love to ask, but I want to get to the audience, because I'm sure Michael wasn't leaving all that space for me to ask questions. Now, we are being recorded, so if you would please step up to the microphone and state your name and ask your question.
Sure. Hi.
Thanks, Young.
Thanks. This is Young from BT Financial Group. Thanks very much for the presentation. I think we're all aligned in wanting to see mental illnesses, the challenge solved. You know, the World Health Organization talks about how depression will be currently is a major cause of disability and all those things. Now, often when a claim presents at claim time, I'm wondering whether we can apply our actuarial skills in understanding which kinds of people are more likely to claim, and what can be done to build more resilient people, because even from the first speaker that we had this morning, she had a happy childhood. She was loved. She had that, and she wanted to share that with other people. And you get the fact that when someone claims, it's actually the last straw that's broken. You know, and have we done any analysis? Have we applied our actuarial skills in helping? You know, in understanding where the vulnerable groups are, and maybe where can we pinpoint to build more resilient children, or more resilient people in general, so that we're not capturing them at the bottom of the cliff. We're building a fence at the top. You'd be interested in your thoughts about that.
Thank you, Yong. Who'd like to take that one?
Thanks for that question. We focused on claims handling, but look, you're absolutely right. There's really three sort of phases. There's the claims handling, you know, and measuring these factors and how analysis of those factors drives what you do at the claims time. There's also what's commonly forgotten in life insurance is actually the time between you put them on risk and before they become a claim. And that is often a forgotten sort of part. Life insurance has been far too low contact, and maybe there's opportunities through wellness programs and other things to, you know, which are targeted physical, but they probably need to be targeted well as well at mental factors and those social and psychological factors, and then the underwriting, we didn't really sort of touch on that, you know, much at all, but just to mention that by the by for completeness.
Thanks, Young. Look, there's considerable research that looks at the correlation between resilience, propensity to change and personality that links people's ability to recover, whether it be in the compensation environment or whether it just be in the health environment. We could actually do a lot better at understanding that at the time that the person actually leaves work by developing closer relationships with the workplace through perhaps it's the superannuation fund or the trustee. But when we understand that quickly, we can also design programs that actually allow that person to be cared for in the way they need to be cared before they even begin thinking about lodging a claim. But I go to Michael's point as well. There's a huge opportunity for the superannuation sector to think about how they can contribute to health in the workplace.
Great, thank you. Adam, take us away.
Adam Puska from Challenger here. Thanks, KPMG team, for a good presentation and ideas. Jane, you've been talking about the biopsychosocial factors for a long time. I'm curious as to your views around what are some of the barriers around why there hasn't been more research around that in Australia, or, you know, more allowance for that in the claims management process in Australia. You talk about a lot of research in the US, but it just doesn't seem to have been sort of much consideration around that in Australia so far.
Thanks, Adam. I'm not taking that as a mark of my success, the fact that I've been talking about it for 15 to 20 years. The reason it has so much relevance, particularly in the workers' comp and the life sector, is because we retrospectively look at our data and we understand that there is almost 60 to 70% of our cause of claim that is called common health conditions, as opposed to CTP or other catastrophic claim scenarios where they have very severe chronic illness or injuries. The reason that the biopsychosocial model fits very well is we also know from research that when you have very common health problems, the long durations are usually not about the medical condition itself. They're usually about other untapped or unknown psychosocial issues that are causing the barrier to that person getting back to productivity or their maximum potential. People respond and change their behaviours within 3 weeks. Anyone who's tried going to the gym will know that if you can keep it up for about 3 to 6 weeks, you're probably going to go for a while. If you give up between 3 to 6 weeks, you're probably done for. So we know that people, in as far as human behaviour, change very quickly. So there's a lot of research that supports that if you actually work with that person quickly and understand perhaps some of those other psychological and social barriers and work to change those, the medical condition doesn't have the same importance. However, the difficulties in the claims environment in Australia have been a lack of technology that has only started to change in the last few years. So the ability for people to actually articulate and identify what the psychosocial factors are early in the claims forum has been very difficult because they have been constantly driven by change and constantly driven by needing to actually improve their claims organisations, and therefore it's quite manual. There's a capability issue as well. Technology is an issue, capability is an issue. You're relying on individual professionals who need to try and access that information through the relationship that they create with the person on claim. That capability issue is starting to change as well, but there has never been, particularly in the Australian industry, a foundation qualification similar to what perhaps the US has, which is a foundation qualification in case management, where people actually have been taught how to access this information early, to analyse it and then to execute or implement on it. They would be two of the main causes that I see that has actually been barriers in the Australian industry to actually implementing a stronger biopsychosocial approach. With that said, there's many attempts going on. There's different rule sets being driven into the claims technology system. There's a more focus on capability to understanding what these issues are. And they are, in fact, in some organisations getting support from actuaries to build algorithms around profiling these kind of issues. Where there continues to be a gap is then actually how to implement it into a good plan in the claims management environment and actually make a difference with the person on claim. There would be two insights that I could share with you at this point.
We could probably squeeze in one more quick question, if you'd like. While you're getting up to the microphone, I might do another one. Is cognitive intelligence sounds fascinating. Is that theory or practice? Is it real?
Cognitive intelligence is very real.
Okay, great.
Brent Walker, and I have had a bit of experience in psychiatric and mental health claims. Not personally, but well, I've had quite a bit of personal experience with a lot of friends and things that have had various mental illnesses, as well as in claims management area as well. But there was one thing that I was scratching my head when I saw the three circles: the biosocial psycho, biopsychosocial circles, because there's another circle that wasn't there, and I was trying to work out where it had gone, and it's the environment circle. Now, is the environment circle one big circle that is right around the whole lot, or is it another circle that you left out? I just don't quite understand.
So if you're referring, Brett, to environment being family circumstance or work, that's included in social. But if you're actually referring to perhaps the system around an individual, such as the political system, the healthcare system, or the compensation sector, you're absolutely right. The biopsychosocial model needs to fit within the system of where the individual is actually sitting.
The person's environment means, is critically important to what's going on.
Yeah.
It's a very important
social includes
point,
family and work. Yeah.
Thank you, everyone. And with the proliferation of bells you can hear ringing means we are over time. Give it up, please, for Michael, Jane and Joshua. Please...